Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The People's Republic of China, PRC, building a huge fleet, building air wing after air wing, making claims against Taiwan, threatening its neighbors, India, Japan, South Korea. Why? We're told that war is imminent. Perhaps, perhaps not. However, there's an old salt from the Romans. If you want peace, prepare for war. These last years, there have been reports across the Pacific of preparation. However, I'm told recently an assessment by the U.S. and its allies is that the first island chain will not hold the initial offensive by the PLA when it moves on Taiwan and moves to break through the Okinawa chain and break out into the Pacific. The first island chain will not hold. Therefore, I'm recently told the second island chain must now be developed, augmented, and prepared for day two of the war. Gregory is in Perth, Australia. Gregory Copley, my friend, advisor, and the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Perth becomes one of the critical nodes, not only for AUKUS, but because we're looking at the second island chain extending into the Indian Ocean. The second island chain is largely unknown to me, but the major component I do recognize is the number of bases that are either underway of being constructed or being enhanced from the Second War or are going to be created in the Northern Territory of Australia. Gregory, help me on this because the geography is shaky. All I've ever seen is a map. I've never flown over it. The Second Island Chain, is Australia committed to augmenting the Second Island Chain because your Northern Territory becomes a major defense against the Chinese advance?
Well, yes. In fact, Darwin was a critical port and airport during World War II as the Japanese moved south. And just after the Pearl Harbor attack, of course, the Japanese attacked Darwin in a much bigger assault than was inflicted on Pearl Harbor, in fact. And there were U.S. Kitty Hawk squadrons there, and they helped to defend Darwin at that time. But Darwin became a major staging point, as did the Perth area with Fremantle as the base. And that situation became critical to the conduct of the Allied war against Japan. During the Second World War, Fremantle was the second biggest U.S. submarine base in the Indo-Pacific and was critical for fighting the submarine war against the Japanese. And it's shaping up that way again as the threat from the People's Republic of China seems to be increasing in some ways. You've got the big submarine base already in HMAS Stirling, which is a base near Fremantle. And you now have, for example, U.S. Virginia-class attack submarines now rotating through that base in near Fremantle, and the British will rotate their nuclear submarines, attack submarines, through there as well. So it becomes analogous to the World War II situation. Now, the first island chain, which goes down, if you like, from Sasebo in Japan through the Okinawa Islands, Taiwan, down through the Philippines to Borneo and Sarawak and literally to Indonesia, that sounds as though it could be fragile and vulnerable to an initial assault from the People's Republic of China. And indeed, that's the case, depending on the level of escalation they use. There is real questioning, however, going on as to whether the PLA could even pull that off or whether they could even pull off an actual amphibious and airborne attack on Taiwan, given the fact that the PLA is fractured in its own command structure. It is weak in its own vessels and inexperienced. There's a great deal of corruption, which has caused a massive rotation of command among the PLA leadership, and particularly in the Strategic Rocket Forces, which controls the nuclear and other strategic ballistic missile forces, which would be used against Taiwan, that would be used against the U.S. forces, and it would also be used against the second island chain, which goes, if you like, down from Yokosuka next to Tokyo in Japan, and down through Guam and down to the northwestern area of Papua New Guinea, or particularly Western Papua, the Indonesian controlled end of it. That is a logical place for the US and the West and Japan, for example, and Australia to reinforce and develop in the event of initial heavy casualties coming through in the first island chain assault by the PRC, should that occur. Now, the reality is that in that first day assault would not just be on the first island chain and not just on Taiwan. It would also very particularly be against Guam. As promised, Japan automatically joins with Taiwan to defend it from the PRC assault. Then Yokosuka itself, the premier naval base for the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces and the principal base in the region for the U.S. Navy, that would also likely be subject to targeting by the PRC. But that brings the PRC into a war which it can then no longer win, because you'd have India moving its forces, currently about 1 million of them in the Kashmir region, that would move up into the Tibetan Plateau and pose a major threat to the PLA control of the Tibetan Plateau, which is critical to the future of mainland China, because it controls the major water supplies. It's the source of the major rivers, not only for China, but also for Southeast Asia, like the Mekong and the like. And it's also the source of the major river flows down through Pakistan, through the Indus Valley. So it's critical that India would respond in that. And that's the promise of the Quad relationship, India, Japan, the United States, and Australia in containing the PRC. So, in fact, you need to look at this whole situation. If there is going to be a major blowout because of some irrational attempt at conflict by the PRC, the second island chain isn't where it stops either. You've got, you could arguably call it the third island chain, which is not necessarily a chain, but islands throughout the central and southwestern Pacific, going across to the Solomons, including countries further east like Fiji and Palau and those sorts of things. And these were critical to the U.S. in World War II, and they'd be critical to the U.S. Again at this time. And it reminds us as to what really makes the United States a global power, in other words, one which can not just influence Europe, but also influence the entire Indo-Pacific, was that it seized and arguably illegally overthrew the government of Hawaii in the 19th century. But and while even U.S., the Secretary of State at the time, said that this was not a legal move by the U.S., it proved to be the most decisive seizure by the United States of a forward base into the Pacific. So Hawaii is part of this, a critical part of this as well.
And Australia, the Australian public is taking a lot on its shoulders. And Anthony Albanese's government has been on again, off again with China. I believe it's off again right now, but I've lost track. Is the Australian public apprised of the part that you will play in the defense of the Pacific, and does it agree?
I would say, by and large, it does agree. I think that they have no idea about the degree to which the Albanese government has ignored its national security obligations in that regard. There are a number of major steps which have been made positively in the improvement of the Australian Defence Forces and the Australian intelligence community, its ability to gain strategic weapons. It's looking, of course, at now acquiring and building its own nuclear attack submarines, but it's going to have to do a lot more than that. And to a degree, it is. It's looking at a lot of unmanned, large underwater attack vessels, in other words, attack submarines which don't have crew on them, but they're remotely controlled. They're looking at a lot more power projection capability. But of course, you've got in the way of that, of them moving forward or northward, is the Indonesian archipelago, and the Indonesians themselves have had an ambiguous relationship with the mainland Chinese. And largely, historically, this has been the case. But when Sukarno became the first president of independent Indonesia after the end of World War II and the collapse of the Dutch presence, President Sukarno was seen as a potential rival to Mao Zedong as the great communist leader in the Indo-Pacific. He was replaced by a much more nationalist figure, Suharto. But now it's interesting. Indonesia's economy is significant and growing. Its defense capability is growing. The U.S. is supplying them with F-15s, which are maybe a bit unsettling to Australia, which sees these as potentially hostile to Australia as well. But we are seeing the new president elect of Indonesia, President-elect Prabowo, who was a former ultra hardline general. He's coming down to Australia for a visit in the next month or so. So that's hoping to build some alternate approaches to the containment of the PRC against the first island and the second island chain. Personally, I think the Chinese Communist Party would rein in Xi Jinping if he attempts to move against Taiwan in the near term. There's no way that the PLA is ready to handle this. They would lose a massive amount of their maritime amphibious forces and their airborne forces should they try to move against Taiwan unilaterally, especially when the thought is that the Japanese would come to their immediate aid even before the United States. So it's going to be very significant, and it's going to be determined literally by the U.S. elections coming up on November the 5th. Because if the Trump administration returns, then there will be much more serious containment of the PRC, and the PRC is already bankrupt. So the question is, can they afford to do anything, or is their bankruptcy going to cause a panic move by Xi Jinping to just lash out to distract the population from their suffering, their hardship, and their starvation?
Last couple of minutes, Gregory. The Cocos Islands and Christmas Island in the Indian Ocean, what do they describe about the Second Island Chain? Why are they useful, if they are, to Australia and the defense of the Pacific?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure whether they fit in either the first or second island chain, but they're Australian island outposts, which are literally just south of Indonesia, the Sumatra and Java main islands of Indonesia. And they give Australia a certain right and a certain capacity to project power, maritime power and air power, up into the South China Sea across Indonesia, should that be required. Australia has a lot of interest in the Indian Ocean, which are not generally talked about, but which are regularly patrolled, the Ashmore and Cartier Reef and so on, which, and by the way, the big threat in these areas is illegal fishing. Some of it's done by the Chinese, but most of it's done by the Indonesians themselves. So it's going to be very interesting, not just with the Cocos Keeling Group and the Christmas Island, but throughout that area, and including Papua New Guinea, which is the eastern half of the island of New Guinea or Papua, which is being courted by the U.S., which has got a big defense agreement with it. Australia has an even bigger national security agreement with Papua New Guinea, and the Chinese have also been wooing them as well. So these are areas where you've got independent countries like Papua New Guinea, like Fiji, like the Solomons and the like, who want to play both sides against the middle to see how much investment they can get from all of the countries. Some of them, including, by the way, Papua New Guinea and particularly Fiji, are extremely pro-West, and Fiji will be playing a big role in the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which will be held in Samoa in October, which is going to be important.
Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs in Perth, Australia. Time for the King Charles Report. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, football fans. Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.